Blog Talk Radio.
Everybody's got the fever. This is something we all know. Fever isn't such a new thing. Fever started long ago.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome to Lenny Godfrey, Straight No Chaser. Thank you so much for tuning in, and we have a wonderful evening planned. Something very different planned this evening. A category of a location that we haven't touched upon yet. But before I get to that, I'm going to do a little housekeeping and to remind you that you are listening to blogtalkradio.com/S as in Sam, F as in Fred, T as in Tom, H as in Harry, and the number 2. And with that information, you can always click on that and you will have access to almost 25 episodes that we've been doing since the end of March. It's been a wonderful, wonderful experience for all of us, and I've had some wonderful guests like I have tonight. If you are interested in calling in to say hello, to have a comment, then you would dial 516-453-6063. And if you want to ask a question, then you press the number 1. So now that's just about all. We know that this program is really dedicated to those people who have been influenced by the arts in their lives early or late, and then have gone on to maybe choose a whole nother vocation or an additional vocation, and how the arts has influenced that. And we found that again and again and again in our guests. So tonight, my guest is a visual artist. We've not had one thus far. Now, Robin is going to tell you what that is. Her name is Robin Joyce Miller. And I have had the privilege of knowing her for a long time through a good friend of mine, Deborah Fudge. And they were teachers together. Not only is Robin a visual artist, Robin is an activist. And she's a teacher. She is a retired teacher, and she had been teaching for more than 30 years. But she spent half of that career learning and teaching disabled students, and the other half as an art teacher. One of the things that we're going to talk about, too, is how much of an investment Robin has made in her life with her students. I wanted to talk about an episode that I learned about how she used to take her students to the museums and how she prepared them for it. Then once she retired, she and her husband maintained two residences, one in New York City and the other one in Cape Cod. And then she started a series, the Black Lives Matter, and she's going to talk about it after George Floyd's murder. So with that, and with her talking about her experiences in museums and her talking about her experiences as an activist, I will introduce you really to this wonderful, wonderful visual artist, Miss Robin Joyce Miller. Hello, Robin.
Hello, Lenny. It is so wonderful to be on your show. Yes, I have had a long career. I am retired, and yet I am not tired of working and continuing being an artist, being a poet, just so many things. What would you like me to talk about first?
Well, first, I'm curious. When I met you, of course, I met you as we were all adults. So I want to go all the way back. Tell me where you were born. Talk to me about a little bit about your parents. And
sure.
The third part is when you thought the arts started to really be a priority in your life. So let's start about when you were born and where you're from.
Well, I'm from Queens, New York, but I was born in Manhattan in the New York Hospital. My father was an artist. My father is the first artist that I ever knew, and he made a living as an artist. He was a graphic artist. He only took 18 months of school. He went to Parsons School of Design. He got that as a scholarship for going to the service for 18 months he had of schooling. And he became an artist and made a career and took care of his family on that. I did not see myself as an artist. I grew up in a family with a mother, a dad, and one younger brother, 4 years younger than me, my brother Barry, who was very much into science. I was an interesting child because I just loved people and fun. Okay, no one knew what I would be. In fact, my grandmother was very concerned. She used to look at my mother and watch me out the window and said, "What's going to become of that child? All she wants to do is play, play, play." And I really did not know what I wanted to do. I kind of liked everything. And my mother exposed me to everything. So as a child, I took ballet. I took tap. I went to charm school and thought I was going to become a model. I modeled, actually, and was in a magazine at 12 years old. I was in Sears catalog. I did lots of things, and I loved the theater. My mother used to take me to plays, and so, and when I watched movies and television, I was very upset that I did not see black people very much in the shows. I wanted to be Jane and Michael Banks in from Mary Poppins. Why aren't there black children? I wanted to act. I wanted to be on stage. I loved actually performing arts. Is as a young person, as I said, I modeled on stage. I did a few things as a child. So I just love the art. It's interesting that I became a visual artist as just a visual artist. But that's my beginning, going to the theater, going to shows, loving music, singing in the house, singing songs, doing puppet shows with my brother, entertaining, telling my friends all my dreams, and dramatizing them. So that's the part of me that you might not have known, and I'm sure you didn't. And you brought that out in making me think of my childhood. So I had an interesting childhood of a lot of fun.
Oh, yes. Now where did you go to school? And when you were in Queens, did you go to the regular academic school? Did you go to a special school?
Yeah, I never went to a special school. I went to the school down the block, and what's interesting, by the way, in my school, because you're in television and you've been in, you know, in the arts and performing arts, but a boy in my class name was Benjamin Hines in my class. Let me tell you who Benjamin Hines' mother was. You know who that was?
No.
Benjamin Hines' mother was Teresa Merritt, okay?
Oh, okay.
So do you know from That's My Mama?
Yes. Oh no, Miss Merritt. Yes, yeah. We know Miss Merritt.
Okay. So Benjamin was in my class. So she used to come to school, and I saw her on a regular basis. But I went to a regular school. I went from kindergarten to sixth grade in my first public school. Then I was bused to a white neighborhood, and I went to that school for 2 years in junior high, and then I moved to the Bronx to Co-op City in the Bronx, and then I went to a school that was well-mixed with Italians, Jews, Puerto Ricans, a well-mixed Irish school, high school. But I never went to a specialized school. College, I went to first Baruch College, City College, then I got my master's at Lehman College. So I went straight public school.
Mm-hmm. When did you, like your father, tell me your father's first name.
My father is Benjamin Elias Bouzet, and he showed art, his gift of art talent at a very young age. In fact, in my art studio right now, I'm looking at one of his early paintings that I have. He did The Seven Dwarfs, and he did that at about 10 years old. And so my father was showing the gift of art as a child. So everyone knew in the family that he was going to be an artist.
Mm-hmm.
So
you're at Lehman College, you're at Baruch. What's your major?
My major at first in I didn't know what I wanted to be. I really didn't. I was absolutely clueless. On my high school, because I had a fabulous aunt who was actually not my mother's sister, but my mother's brother's wife, and because my mom only had brothers, so I didn't have an aunt that way through blood. But Aunt Dot loved the theater, and she used to take me to shows. She impressed me so much with her life. She was flamboyant. She used to make all her clothes from Vogue magazine, and she went on cruises. I wanted her life, and she worked at CBS as an executive secretary. So when I decided what I was going to be, I said, I'll be an executive secretary like my Aunt Dot. I went to Baruch College, which was a business college, and as I started taking business courses, I realized I absolutely hate business. This is not who I am. And my mother-in-law, who was not my mother-in-law, but she was a mentor because she started help. My mother and my mother-in-law started the National Council of Negro Women in Co-op City. So there was a young, my mother-in-law had the young girls group, and she is the person who told me that I should become a teacher. And while I was going to Baruch, I transferred because at the time they had an education department there. And so I went into education after 2 years of being at Baruch College. I changed my major and went from business to sociology and then to education. And that's how I got into teaching.
The experience of education, then what at what point did you start to incorporate when you taught? You taught disabled students and you taught art.
Yes.
How did that start? How did that happen?
Okay, how did that start? Well, first of all, while I was going to student teaching, some of the teachers said, you're a good artist, because in my lessons I started drawing and whatever. However, when I became a special education teacher, I realized that the students were struggling to learn social studies. And it was hard for them to read the chapter and really understand. So what I started doing was reading the chapters, summarizing it, and having the children do illustrations and draw. Many of them could draw. So I, with them, started drawing chapters and parts of the story, and they memorized better when they drew some of the things that were going on. They understood better, and I understood. I never liked history, but when I started illustrating it for the children, they became more interested, and I became more interested. And at some point, I said, oh, I like this. I like this because I'm learning about as I'm going, and I started having the children do interesting bulletin boards, and then I started doing work also. I was working along with them. And as I did that, I realized how much I was enjoying myself. And the children even said, you look like you're having a good time, Mrs. Miller. And I said, oh, I absolutely am doing that. And that was while I was teaching special education. And I started teaching a class I started working with other teachers doing workshops. My principal said, why don't you do workshops telling the teachers how they can use art? Now, at the same now, I'm not an art teacher, but I'm telling teachers and doing workshops, showing them what I'm doing in my classroom, having children make up little books for science and social studies that they draw pictures of everything to better understand what the concepts are.
I see. So That evolved once you realized you had that interest in art, that evolved and shared the education. How did you feel once you unearthed this wonderful formula where you found that the children could express themselves better through art? How then did that influence you to start doing the pieces of art that I've seen that you had? How long after that did you start working on
it? Well, it took a while because, first of all, I thought that maybe I can go back to school and take art and start, you know, doing art. And I asked my principal, do you think that you'll ever have an art teacher? And he said, no, there's no money in the school for the arts. There's no this, there's whatever. My mother-in-law, always reading the New York Times, we used to eat Sunday meals at her house, and she said one day she whips out the New York Times and says, you know, Robin, the Annenberg family are giving billions of dollars to New York City for the arts. They feel that it's important that New York City start teaching the arts. And I said, what? And so when I thought about taking a sabbatical, there was a college, a community college, LaGuardia Community College, had a program for a sabbatical program, and one of the programs was visual arts. So when I was on sabbatical, I went for the visual arts program. Now, what was interesting about that was that teachers taking that were not trying to become artists. They just wanted something to do on sabbatical. I took it seriously. I got my 16 credits for the, you know, taking the arts. And then when I came back after a sabbatical, my principal said to me, even before that, because that was the first year they were doing a program in New York City called Project Arts. And my principal said, Robin, when you come back, I'm going to make you the art teacher because we need an art teacher. And so I was taking art during that time. And when I came back, I was part-time special ed teacher and part-time art teacher. And so I put myself back into school to get 36 credits in art so that I could become an official art teacher and get a license, because they were finally giving an art license to elementary school art teachers. And so I said, I'm determined to get that so that no one can take my position away from me. So I plowed in and I studied and got, even after a master's and after 30 credits already above my master's, I went back for art to get another 36 credits so that I could be an art teacher and stay an art teacher.
Well, now that's admirable. So you maintain this. At what point did you start doing professional shows? Did you, you know, at what point then, after you were getting once you got all your degrees and you got yourself secured in the school system, did you, at what point did you start doing the artwork that I started to
see? Okay, well, I left something out. Okay, because during the time, okay, the activism part came in as well. So what started happening is, as a young child, I was very insecure, I did not feel proud of my African heritage. I just didn't see anything about being black that to me felt positive. I grew up during the civil rights movement. I saw how blacks were treated in the South and said, something must be wrong with us if we're so hated and whatever. So there was that going on as well. And while I'm still a special ed teacher, another thing that happened, I started drawing, I started doing cartoon drawings. So my cartoon drawings turned into me drawing multicultural children, and because my school was full of multicultural children. So I started, and I came up with a name for myself, RJ, for Robin Joyce, RJ Scribble. And even your dear friend Debbie, what happened when there was a racist problem in New York with a Korean grocery store in Brooklyn, and it got very ugly. Mayor Dinkins, our first African-American mayor, said he got very upset and said teachers need to do something for peace and racial harmony. Mm-hmm. So I said, I'm going to take my scribble kits and I'm going to write a poem and I'm going to take this to the mayor. And Debbie went with me, and another teacher, Angela Brown, went to the mayor's office with this first piece of art, this cartoon art that showed multicultural children with the mayor in the middle, and I called it the Blue Ribbon Committee for Peace and Racial Harmony. And the poem, I wrote a poem to go with it that I've always carried around with me, and that was the beginning of my being an activist and saying, you know what, I am for peace and racial harmony, and I'm going to use these cartoon children that I draw to promote peace and harmony. And after I did that, I ended up getting a Pepsi ad honoring Dr. Martin Luther King, which was in Ebony, Essence, Black Enterprise. Every black magazine and newspaper carried the ad that I did illustrating children who were honoring Dr. King. So Pepsi used my ad to honor Dr. King, and I have that to this day. And
what?
And there was the poem, and so that was the beginning of my art and my activism. They came together.
Well, what I can see that. What is your favorite part of what it is that you do? What's the favorite? What is, if you had to pick out something? This is asked of me a lot of times when you're high, because you're a hyphenated person. You know, when you're a hyphenated person,
I'm high energy.
You have more than one thing that you're known for. What is the favorite moment that you can think about of all the things that you do, that you had?
When I get up and perform, it's not doing. I love to create art. I love to write poetry, I love to write stories now, narratives to tell the stories. I love to put them together. I love to find the music that's going to go with it. But standing up in front of people, performing is what I absolutely love. And I'm just going to do this one for you. When people come to my African American Museum and they are in awe that we even have a Black museum on Cape Cod, I show them my book, The Faithful Journey, with my African American history quilt from slavery to presidency. And then I do this with them. I want to bring you guys to Inauguration Day where Obama became president. And so I have them do this. Obama, Obama, a day to scream and shout. Obama. Obama! Massive crowds came out. The trumpets bellowed loudly. The bells rang through the air. Pomp and circumstance were felt. Just magic everywhere. People waved their flags about. The red, the white, the blue. Echoes of a dream once heard. Sweet victory come true. Prayers were lifted, speeches made. Then our girl Aretha came to sing. From every mountainside we know, let peace and freedom ring. My country, 'tis of thee, sweet land of liberty, of thee I sing. And I have the people sing it with me, and then I say, excellent. Obama's oath was taken. Hail to the chief was played. The cannons fired through the air. Out rolled his motorcade. They cruised past waving people. You heard more screams and shouts. God bless our first Black family en route to the White House. Glory, hallelujah, I heard our forefathers sing. From every mountainside we know, let peace and freedom ring. And that
Lovely.
Is what I love to do.
Well, and doing that and being, I think, inspired to do that, where do you think we are then in the process of diversity? Because I think we are in a different place now than we were when you wrote that poem.
But here's the thing. I get asked, as an activist here on the Cape, I get asked the question, do you think we're turning a corner? Okay. After the George Floyd verdict with what was his name, COVID, what I forgot now, I don't want to say it wrong, but anyway, they said, "Do you think we're turning a corner?" I said, "I think we thought we were turning a corner when slavery ended. We thought we were turning a corner. Construction came. We thought we were turning a corner. When civil rights movement." Was passed. The Civil Rights Act was passed. We thought we were turning a corner. When Dr. King got up and made his incredible speech, we thought we were turning a corner. When Dr. King, after he was killed and they made a Dr. King birthday, we thought we were turning a corner. We have thought, when Barack Obama became president, we thought we were turning a corner. And we have thought we were turning a corner. And we are. However, I don't look at things and go, oh, it's going to be wonderful now. I think that what we did see with George Floyd was we saw the world come together. Even in other countries, they were protesting, and we saw everyone come out. And little Gianna said, "My daddy changed the world." And we did see a change. And people are more willing, like on the Cape right now, once that happened, people said, the director of the Kituit Center for the Arts said to me, "Robin, it's time for white people to listen to black stories." And I said, "Okay, I got some, I'm the one to tell some black stories." So he said, "Do you think you could do a Black Lives Matter series that could do, from, this was now in July, from August to one a month, five of them till the end of the year, from August to December?" I said, "I could try. I've done slideshow presentations." So that's when I got busy, and I did five shows. And I put everything that I've ever done as a teacher, my art, my poetry, narration, my husband's poems. We got together, and we just said, we're going to do, this is the moment. So I do feel that this is a moment, and things are happening. But things have always been happening, and we just have to keep fighting.
Let me ask you this. Given all of the activism that you do, and mm-hmm. we're going to touch quickly on your husband, but I'm going to bring him the subject of having your husband and that supportive thing. I'm bringing that in. Given all the activism that you do, connecting it with the visual arts that you have, do you think that there needs to be... Well, no, I don't want to place it like that. I don't want to give you the answer. What do you think we can do in our systems so that art teaches us more of the history that we have, the American history that we have, the stumbles and the successes that we have, and how would you do that through visual arts?
Okay, we'll see. None of us can take on the world exactly. The way I handled it was one time I did it in my classroom. Being the art teacher of the school, I made sure that the visual arts was all about cultural arts. And I wanted to honor not just African American, but in my school, children came from all over the world. So I wanted to honor culture and say that every culture contributes, every group, in the, every country contributes to the culture of America. And so people have to take it. It's one step and one person at a time. There are people who, I've never been a person who worked with a whole big administration and changed things. I have seen changes. The New York City, when they put that arts program in place, they put cultural arts in place. All of a sudden, they had Faith Ringgold. They named all these African-American artists who they worked into the curriculum for teachers to teach in the dance, in because the blueprint for the arts in New York was about a lot of, it had dance, it had music, it had theater, it had all of these visual arts, it had all these areas, and they worked all nationalities and groups, you know, into it. So it's really upon people listening to make the change one person at a time. You know, I don't try to change the world. I try to change my circumstance, where I am at that time. Here I'm on the Cape and I'm doing something that I can put on YouTube that goes out into the world, but I'm making my change here with the people that I see on a regular basis. How the arts can do it, the museums get involved, the, you know, and so I don't really, it's a hard,
wait, Robin. Okay.
Yeah.
So tell me, and I love your stream of consciousness, but I need to be able to kind of connect some of it because I want the audience to not only know that what you are doing, but connecting the art of what you're doing within what you are doing. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Okay. Yeah, okay.
All right. So what, when you bring about the museum, when you bring about how the art of diversity is being, I think, translated into that. Tell me how it is in the Cape, because that's where you are, and, you know,
yes,
and that, you know, that's your life experience. Tell me
right now.
Yes, right now, in the Cape, how is that working for you? What happens in that spectrum? So you say
okay.
you're at a museum. What happens?
Okay. So first of all, I started working in the African American Museum, and bus tours. They started bus tours, so people are coming in to the museum, mostly African American groups from all over, and they're seeing the art in that museum. But I think what you're asking is also how does black art and what we're doing?
No, I want American.
No, it doesn't
art.
Have to be black art. You just want to know art.
Yes. Well, let me just take you one step at a time. When you say they come to that museum and they're coming to see the art in that museum, what is the art in that museum? What is it?
They're coming to see the museum itself, and it tells the story of black people on the Cape. However, there are artists on the Cape who have their art there. I'm one of the artists. There's Carl Lopes, who's a Cape Verdean. He has his art there. There's another person with art there. So there's a few artists who have their art there, though this is not an art museum. This is a museum about people of color on the Cape. However, there are artists there, and we show our art. When the buses come, all three artists represent our art, and we talk about our art there.
Okay. Tell me
one.
A little bit more about this. When was it established?
What was established?
The museum.
The museum. Okay. Okay. That museum came up. It looks like a church. And what I would like people to do is see it on, I did my last show was called Coming Black, Tell the History of Black People on the Cape. And what I learned from the museum, it tells about the museum and the things that I've learned from that museum. So that museum carries the history of people of color on Cape Cod. That's basically what it's about. And it started in 1909 as a church. It was first it's called the Zion Union Heritage Museum, but it was the Zion Mission Church because there were black people who were servants, and they were serving white people, but they were going to the local church in Hyannis. This is in Hyannis. They were going to a Baptist church, one particular black woman and her friends. They were told by people in the church, you would be more comfortable in going to your own church, a church with people of your own kind. So the woman stopped going to church. One of the white members of the church went to visit her to find out why she wasn't going. She told the story. He built that church. William Drew, along with other people, got together and built this black church that became the first church for people of color on Cape Cod, built in 1909. It has expanded for quite a few years. It expanded in 2007. It became a museum. And then the church itself built a bigger church. So that's the museum that is there.
In that museum, then, you have contemporary artists.
You have contemporary artists, and you have artifacts and photographs of people and share different things that people used and became, were important to the community.
I see. Okay, so now, what drew you to Cape Cod?
Okay. For years, when I started in 1991, our son, Jim and I had one son, and our son was 4 years old in 1991, and we went to Martha's Vineyard. Lots of blacks go to Martha's Vineyard for vacation. We vacationed there almost every year until 2006. And by 2007, my son was 20 years old, and so now he did not. I went with friends, and we decided, let's go to Cape Cod. I never had planned on living in Cape Cod. I believe that it was a God, divine kind of thing because everything just unfolded in such a way that one thing easily led to another. We vacationed there, and I loved the place. And we had sold land in Sag Harbor that we owned. And next thing you know, we were looking for a house on Cape Cod. It's too long a story to tell, but that's how it was. It started by vacationing in Martha's Vineyard and then saying, okay, well, this is right across the the water, you know, it's the mainland, Cape Cod, and let's check it out. And next thing you know, there I was. But it's not something that I ever, ever thought that I was going to do. Even the year that I vacationed, I did not initially think I was going to buy a house in Cape Cod.
But that did happen, and you did.
Yes,
you
it did.
The dualities of New York City and Cape Cod. So what about it made you, you know, I know you said it's a long story, but what about it made you stay and want to contribute your artistry to that community?
Well, the first thing we felt was that we'll just buy a house there, not to live, but just like people in the vineyard, we'll rent it out. We'll buy a house. We'll live in New York. It's a getaway. We'll have a getaway. But the house that we bought was all year round in a regular neighborhood. It wasn't in one of those beach neighborhoods. It's in a regular neighborhood. It was built in 2000. We bought the house in 2007. So it was a new house and three bedroom. And we were buying it to kind of rent it out. When the people, and we ended up having a Brazilian family live here for 4 years, from 2009 to 2013. When they left, we were going to prepare it for more people to live in it. However, I connected to the African American Museum. My friends and my realtor said, you never enjoyed your house. Before you start trying to put other people in it, why don't you just at least spend one summer? So the summer of 2013 was the first summer that we got to enjoy our house. And then I connected to the African American Museum, and I connected to the church that's down the road from us, where we are very much involved in activism. And they are now hanging in my church. Last month, I did a sermon, my fifth sermon there. I'd never done a sermon until I came to Cape Cod and to that church, all white church, Pilgrim Church, the oldest congregational church in the country, and it was built in 1717. They welcomed me in. They put me in the pulpit, and as of last month, I gave them my Ethiopian Coptic Christian Last Supper painting, and they're hanging that black Jesus in their white church. Okay?
All right. Now, that's fabulous. So now I see how you've incorporated the visual artistry into the activism.
Yeah.
Because yes, that's the arc that I wanted to see is how where you are now, how you've incorporated, but it started with the teaching that the children inspired you by letting you know that they could learn better if it was visual than if it was academic. And then you took on the challenge of going a little bit further with that and creating the artistry, and that led to your activism. And almost now the activism has taken a priority into the visual arts, but it's an aid to it. How do you
I need to say this, that I started teaching the children with the art, but then it was a way for me to learn about my history. So each of those activists, so when you ask how, I started by doing the art. Each quilt that I did was a narrative of a certain period of African-American history, from slavery to presidency. To do each quilt, I had to do lots of research, do a lot of reading, find out a lot of information. When I put the book together, the book became one thing, but then the shows that I told you I'm doing, that's all my art is in those shows, in the Langston Hughes. It's my art, my Langston Hughes collection. So I'm putting my art into those shows to continue teaching, to continue learning. So it's all entwined in there.
So tell me a little bit, because we don't have a whole lot of time left now, Robin. And of the visual of the arc of your work. So tell me now, because the visual arc has led us through academics, activism, and so I want to really feel now about the craft that you're doing. You mentioned quilts. So how did you get into that? What choice did you have? Why did you choose that craft, that expression? And talk to me a little bit about this.
Well, first of all, I need to tell you that these are not sewn quilts. These are mixed media collages that I call quilts because I use the composition of a quilt. I like to tell a story in patches, and
mm-hmm.
so I
mm-hmm.
think that the narrative of a quilt lends itself to telling a story, and it's also part of our heritage. African American women created quilts, and some of them told stories like Harriet Powers, and that whole concept of I love. So so my pieces are done on canvas or paper with paper and materials. Sometimes I add fabric, but they are not sewn unless I'm embroidering into it. However, they are not sewn pieces. I just call them quilts, and it is a tool that I use to teach and tell a story, a narrative in those works of art.
So for my audience, let me just say, so what you're saying is quilts, the way that we usually refer to them is, and a lot of cultures do them, is that sometimes they are used for warmth, because my grandmother, great-grandmother all used to make
mm-hmm.
quilts and send us up in New York City. But what yours are is not that particular camp. You use that methodology, but it's
right.
not, it isn't for warmth. It is to tell the story. Now, so are your quilts in a frame? Are they framed? Are
some
they free
are.
Flowing? Uh-huh. And so they're in exhibit.
They're paper.
And they're exhibited.
They're paper or they're on canvas. Now some of them are on canvas. So they're not like a quilt that is sewn made of fabric. They are not blankets. They are collage pieces. They're really pieces
right.
of collage
right.
that look like quilts.
Right.
They have
and
the border of a quilt. They have patches. They have things that make them look like a quilt, but they are paper and paint.
And they are on display in the museum?
They're in a variety of different places. Right
okay.
now, the Kituit Center for the Arts has an exhibit called Heritage, which has art from the Zion Museum. The Zion Museum has my art in it. My art has been in several of the museums on the Cape.
Okay. Now, so what I want to do in these last, because we only have about 12 minutes left. I told you it goes fast. And
yes, it does.
Yes. So I want to kind of build the whole arc of, because you talked about, you talked about being you spoke in the church. You have the craft of quilting. You have the performance. A part of your presentation. So all of these, putting them all together now when I think about it, but before I get that, first of all, you talked about your mother-in-law, before she was your mother-in-law, was somewhat of a mentor to you.
Yes.
How did that relationship lead to the marriage of this man who has obviously been a very, very supportive part of your life? Just to deviate a little bit away so that we can get
okay.
That part of your life. So, okay.
Okay, because the meetings, the first time I ever saw my husband was my 16th birthday. And by the way, he was 14. Okay? And my mother pointed him out to me. She said, I think that's Mrs. Miller's son. And I smiled, okay? The meetings were at the junior council. They were both in the National Council of Negro Women, my mother and his mother, and she was a teacher. So the meetings were at her house. And so when I went to the house, I saw her son. And then we saw each other. And so a year later, that was in 1971. In 1972, he actually asked me to go with him, and the rest is history. We've been together since 1972. We got married in 1980. Our family, so it was 8 years because we had to go to college and go to school. So we both went to college and school in New York. We still continue dating. By the time we did get married, I knew all of his family. He knew all of my family because we had been together so long. We shared the holidays. So it was one big, and living in Co-op City, his mother and my mother had a lot of the same friends. We had 300 people at our wedding, and they all practically knew each other. Okay?
Good. Yes. And that's lovely. What I wanted to try to see is to connect is how does that relationship, is that relationship supportive of all the various things that you do? Because being a hyphenated person, how does it function in your life, and how does it help you, you know, to complete all the things that you want to do? That relationship, because...
Okay, but when you connected my mother-in-law to my husband, there's not a real connection there. That connection was one thing with my mother-in-law. My husband and our relationship, really, one doesn't really have to do with the other. It's our relationship, we're both two very creative people. And, and so he is a person who was writing poetry when he was in college. He was writing poems and he was sharing it with his friends. And he wrote poems to me. So it was when I always wanted, when we got married, I always wanted to do something with him. And so when we both retired, and that's another long story, but when we both retired, I said, why don't you join me on this book? Because we went to Africa together in 2010 and renewed our vows on top of Elmina Castle, looking out at the Atlantic Ocean, wearing African clothing. But we both wrote poems when we were in Africa, and he wrote The Door of No Return. So his poetry is in my in the history. And so I asked him to join me and write some of his poems, and we put them in a book together. And so we have continued to work together.
See, that's the
he was in banking. He was not opposed.
Connecting the arts all the way through your life, in your personal life as well as your professional life, and trying to explain to people how the arts has influenced your life all the way through your life, even though when you first began, as you told the story, you didn't quite know where your path has. Once you discovered
right.
it, what you've done right. is that you've intertwined it into everything that you, the arts has been intertwined into everything that you've chosen to do. You've chosen and intertwined it into education. You've chosen and intertwined it into the moving where you are and becoming an activist. The act of actually being a visual artist and studying all of those things to become an arts teacher, all of that has started it. And then ultimately your life has been influenced by the arts because you are now more than a visual artist. I mean, you
yeah.
are a native person who has now, like, and I'm listening to you now because this conversation was to find out all the facets that you have, where you have written a book, where you incorporate performance, where you have done ministry, and then you have the crafts of the quilting and a certain kind of quilting.
Well, I just want to say I don't have the craft of quilting because it's my craft is art. It's collage. So I don't want to say, because a quilter does a lot of different things, okay?
Collage.
Which is quilting. I don't quilt.
Yeah, but you do it in a method that we are familiar with, that how you take patches of things and bring them together. But all of this, I believe, is all connected, underlying with the influence of whether you knew it or not as a child, once you recognized how art could really, I think, create a path, and a path that you followed all the way through.
And
that, you know, it's all the way through everything that you've done and in your description of all the things that you've done, which is why I wish I had another hour to, you know, to let you illuminate all of those facets. That's why I had to kind of go, okay, but yes, I need to get to this part. And so it's
fascinating. You need to get right.
You know, it was just fascinating to find out in this last 40-50 minutes all of the things that you have done in your life and how definitely the arts has been an influence of it and has pushed you through it. I would say, you know, there are people who, when they are I think they have a range of music. They call them a musicologist. You would be an artologist for me. And, you know, a person, if I made up a word, a person who you have varied talents and varied paths, but all the one string is it, is that you've always been able to take the arts and utilize that in every single thing that you've done, and the creativity
yeah.
of it. You know, when you're up
yeah.
and performing, you know, that's an art form that you enjoy.
Yeah.
You are doing
yeah.
your collage. It's an art form that you can, but also within that whole thing, you are also communicating messages. When you have your Black Lives Matter, you creatively do it, but there's a message for it. So therefore, it is stringing itself through with your activism.
It's storytelling,
so,
too. It's
yes,
storytelling.
You know, and all of that, all of those things, which we will get to when we do a little bit, because we're almost out of time now, and I want to give people who've called in an opportunity.
Oh, I forgot about people.
yes. People have been listening. An opportunity to ask you any questions. There is one person, see, they were waiting for me to open it up for them to ask a question of you and your stories. So before we add anything on, I'm going to go to this question and ask the person to identify themselves, tell me who they are and where they're from. And thank you and welcome to Lenny Gossi Straight No Chaser. And please tell me your name and where you're from.
Hi, this is Deborah Fudge-Rem, and I am talking to two of my favorite sisters. I am listening, and I am fascinated. I'm even learning more about you, Robin. It's wonderful.
Oh, my
so hi,
goodness.
Hi, ladies. Hi, girls.
I thought you were going to be there.
I got home in time, so I wanted to say, Robin, you should really be running, like, the art department for the Department of Education, because let me explain why. The things that
okay,
you were able
ahead.
To pull out your students, because I watched you, to be able to know that your special ed students needed another way to understand the lessons
exactly.
and to use
yes.
art to bring
yeah.
that out
yes.
in them is so important.
Yes.
And I also
yes.
wanted you to talk maybe a little bit about how you prepared our students, especially our Black and Brown students, who they say are going to run through the museums, how you got them to understand how they're supposed to behave at an art gallery or a museum,
yeah.
and how you
yeah.
would get letters and phone calls letting our principal know that our students behave so beautifully. Because a lot of times, you know, there are teachers who won't take their students anywhere because they're saying, oh, they can't behave. But if you have
right.
faith in them and if you teach them correctly, they will. So just tell Carol a little bit about how you prepared them for those kinds of events.
Okay. Okay, I don't think you're going to want to hear exactly what I said to the kids, which is what my mother said. Don't embarrass me when we get out there.
That's exactly what we all say to our children.
If you want me to take you on trips, okay, that was important. And also, I taught children, even from kindergarten and others, how to do the gallery walk. We practiced putting your hands behind your back and walking and looking with your head, not with your fingers. And we talked about being quiet in the museum. We talked about I gave them, like you said, clipboards for them to look at, to do some sketches, to keep them busy. Also, you don't go to a rock concert without having heard the musician. You already know the musician. So when I took them to the museum, if I'm taking them to Van Gogh, they've seen videos on Van Gogh. They've seen Van Gogh's art. I've read stories. So when they finally see a Van Gogh painting, they are excited because they feel like, I know something about him. So you don't take children to a museum without preparing them by showing them, telling them stories about the art that they're going to see, telling them what to look for, talking about the questions that they might have in their heads. So they ask intelligent questions to, you know, the people working at the museum. And we actually did pictures once and gave them to the Metropolitan Museum because I had them do a study on museums and what is in a museum. And they collected the children's art
They did art boards that we gave them, and they used it in a conference. And my friend, who is a professor and works at the Metropolitan Museum, he called me to say, because I told him I knew him, to say that they were impressed. The museum was impressed with what you've done with the children. So it was really about preparing them, talking to them, loving them.
Well, I think what you're saying is that there was an investment in the children that happened when one has a shared life experience, when one has a shared investment in children that look like them, that may have experiences like them, that may not even look like them, but have sensitivities like them. I think the gift of a natural, genuine teacher, that both you and Deborah are that, and I have many friends who are teachers because I wanted to be one myself. I always say to people that when you express an investment in a child, they respond. Yes, you may start off like, you know, with a little reprimand saying, look, the first thing we're going to do is we're going to know how to behave here because you're not going to embarrass me here. But just saying that, let the child
not
know
good enough,
you care, but you care
right.
enough about how they're being presented to other people.
Exactly.
And that's the important thing.
Yeah.
You know, it's very, very
right.
important. That's why, you know, that bit of parenting that happens in our classroom, that is artistic as well. I believe how you then again showed them how to use the artistry in through the education. I'm telling you, it's a thread, Robin, that I don't even know that you knew yourself. I was just trying to make that thread all the way through. You've had it all the way through your life, and it's still there. And we will talk in 2 minutes about what you're going to be doing, because we are running out of time now. So, as I said, Fudge will tell you, these things go quickly. Thank you so much, Deborah, for calling
in. You're so welcome. Love you, ladies.
Thank
love
you, my
you
love.
Too.
Thank you. Love you too. But you know,
that was a nice surprise.
Yes, it was. You know, the whole point of us recognizing how important art influences all us all the way through our lives. That's what this whole program is about. And then in a few minutes when we talk in video, and think you'll have a little time to think about where you're going and what you want to do, and then recognizing how important the arts has been in your life, what you want to utilize that for. So in this last minute and a half, I'm going to thank you so very much for sharing so many wonderful experiences that you have had.
It's been a great pleasure.
You're wonderful. I just, you know, I was like, okay, I wanted to talk more, but I'm not going to be able to get to the next part. I wanted to be able to show all of the different areas that you have really been experiencing and how the arts has influenced you in that way. So, ladies and gentlemen, I thank you also for tuning in. There are those of them who are here, that we've got a lot of people who tuned in, but that was the one question. And we're going to go to the after show afterthoughts, and we'll see you in a little while. So thank you so much, Robin, and I'll see you in a bit. Okay. Thank you, everyone.
All right. Thank you.
And thank you, everyone, for joining into Lenny Godfrey Straight, No Chaser. Have a wonderful evening. Thank you.
Thank you.
This is something we all know. Fever isn't such a new thing. Fever started long ago. Never know how much I love you. You never know how much I care. When you put your arms around me, I get a feeling that's too hard to bear. You give me fever. When you kiss me, fever, when you hold me tight. Fever in the morning, fever all through the night. Listen to me, baby, hear every word I say. No one can love you the way I do, 'cause they don't know how to love you. For